dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the War of Ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. For decades, if not centuries, perhaps even millennia, the Middle East has been a central battle space in the war for the free world, even before we saw it as such. It has been particularly a place where the state of Israel, with its traditions of freedom and human rights and values, which of course has been the critical ingredient in the very strong relationship between the United States and the modern state of Israel, but going back to its founding, the Jewish state has been a remarkable exemplar of freedom. And a man who has done as much as anybody in our current generation, for sure, to help explain the character of the Jewish state, to help advocate on its behalf, and help the rest of us understand why it is so vital to the United States and its interests in that region and beyond, that Israel be strong and free and safe, is our guest for this full hour, I'm very pleased to say. He is Ambassador Yoram Ettinger. He's very generous with his time. We often seek his counsel on developments in the Middle East, and occasionally we have a chance to do it in depth, and this is one of those occasions. I couldn't be more pleased. Mr. Ambassador, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. It's so good to have you with us. Mr. Ambassador, you have been, among other things, a senior diplomat in Israel. That is a vantage point from which you have both served your country in the Jewish state, of course, but also here as the Minister for Congressional Affairs in our embassy, the Consul General for the southwestern U.S. at one point as well. You have a deep understanding of both countries, and I guess one of the things I'd like to do with the very outset is to have you, in your inimitable way, sort of set the predicate. Tell us how you see the U.S.-Israel relationship at the moment, and why it is so vital for both countries for it to be strong and robust.
Well, first and foremost, U.S.-Israel relations constitute a very unique phenomena in the area of international relations. It's unique because it's a bottom-up type of phenomena. Namely, it's the American people that register their special attitude towards the Jewish state, towards Jewish values. They register it with their representatives in the House, in the Senate, and also in the White House. And in reality, the members of the House and the Senate perform that which their constituents instruct them to do. And the reason that there is such a special attitude towards Israel, bottom-up attitude, it goes back exactly 400 years to the Mayflower, which arrived to the northeastern coast of the contemporary USA, and the passengers, the 102 passengers of the Mayflower, considered themselves to be the modern-day chosen people. They referred to England as the modern-day Egypt, and the voyage through the Atlantic as the modern-day parting of the sea. And therefore, we have today in the U.S., or you have today in the U.S., some 1,000 sites bearing biblical names, small towns, large towns, deserts, national parks, mountains, I reside in Jerusalem, Israel. That's the only Jerusalem we have in Israel. But in the U.S., there are 18 Jerusalems, and there are 32 Salems. Salem is the original biblical name of Jerusalem. But anyway, this, in my mind, these are the roots, 400-year-old roots of the very special attitude towards Israel, which, by the way, reflects itself through some 200 monuments of the Ten Commandments throughout the U.S., the statues of Moses in the House of Representatives, in the Supreme Court, in the Library of Congress, etc. On that foundation, we have experienced remarkable voyage of joint strategic interest between the two countries. And today, in 2020, Israel, in my mind, is the chief force multiplier for the U.S. We are, in the words of the late General Alexander Haig, we are the largest American aircraft carrier, which does not require a single American on board and is deployed in a most critical area for American interests between the Mediterranean and the Indian Ocean, between Asia and Africa and Europe. And if there were not Israel in the western part of the Middle East, then the U.S. probably would have to deploy a few more real aircraft carriers to this area, a few more ground divisions to this area at a cost of some $15 billion or so dollars annually. And we have had a relationship which are unique because they combine ideology and values and politics, as well as, and maybe most importantly, very, very joint strategic military defense concerns. We are faced with mutual threats, Iran's Ayatollahs and Sunni Islamic terrorism, and we also work together on enhancing our technology, both commercial as well as defensive. And in reality, Israel has been the most effective, cost-effective, battle-tested laboratory for the American armed forces as well as for the American defense industries. And once again, without the need of positioning a single American soldier in Israel. And I am not aware of any similar type of relations between the U.S. and any other country.
It certainly is. And in just to emphasize something that was implicit in what you said, Mr. Ambassador, but I think needs to be further underscored, is Israel has always sought to be its own and resilient asset in the Middle East, not a dependency of the United States. When we come back after a short break, Mr. Ambassador, I want to talk with you about how that's working out in practice and some of the challenges that Israel is facing that require our strong support as well. That and more with Ambassador Yoram Edinger of Israel right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back. We are visiting with the author of the Edinger Report, a really valuable window on what's happening in the Middle East, what's happening in the U.S.-Israel relationship, and more broadly, the vital interests of both nations, his own and ours. We're speaking, of course, Ambassador Yoram Edinger. Mr. Ambassador, thank you again for your time. You were speaking very powerfully about, you know, how this relationship between the United States and Israel has sort of evolved over the years and why it is so important, I think quite convincingly, let me say. I wanted to ask you about the latest development in that bilateral context, namely the introduction with much fanfare and the personal imprimatur of the current acting Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, of a peace plan advanced by President Trump and his son-in-law, Jared Kushner. The president calls it the deal of the century, a vision for peace. You've written in the Edinger Report back in January about the battle, as you put it, between reality-driven, politically incorrect folks and their worldview on the one hand, and what you call the wishful thinking, oversimplification-driven, politically correct worldview. Would you describe, first of all, what's in this plan, this deal of the century, and where it falls in the spectrum between those two points of view?
Well, to the credit of President Trump, he is the first president who apparently has realized that the U.S. Should not hold its initiatives hostage to the Palestinian issue. He's also probably the first president who has highlighted the independence of the U.S. diplomatic action, irrespective of the position of the U.N., the Europeans, or the Third World. And certainly, he has been a president who has recognized the very unique contribution by Israel to the U.S. That has expressed itself in the current peace plan, which he submitted a few weeks ago, in the form of recognizing the legality of Jewish settlements, communities in the mountains of Judea and Samaria, and the right of Israel to apply its law, its sovereignty, to certain parts of Judea and Samaria. The problem which I have detected in the Trump plan is the inclusion in that package of a potential Palestinian state. I'm aware of a number of very important preconditions for the Palestinians to have such a state, but I'm also aware of the fact that the interpretation of those preconditions are very, very subjective. And while I trust very much President Trump's own interpretations, in reality, President Trump will not be in the White House after January 2025. There will be another president succeeding President Trump, possibly, I hope not, but possibly also in January 2021. There is a possibility that this president, the succeeding president, will be a Democrat who will have much more lenient interpretation of those preconditions. And we have seen that in the past with Presidents Clinton and Obama, who in fact were the attorneys on behalf of one of the most ruthless terrorists in recent history, Yasser Arafat. Irrespective of Arafat's unprecedented terrorism, unprecedented hate education, they vouched for his good behavior. They vouched for him as worthy of extremely generous American financial assistance, as well as deserving a state of his own. With all due respect to President Trump, he will not be there to guarantee that his strict interpretation of those preconditions will be maintained by his successors, which could lead to a Palestinian state. A Palestinian state on the mountain ridges of Judea, Samaria, first and foremost, would doom the pro-U.S. Hashemite regime in Jordan. It's either a Palestinian state west of the river or a Hashemite regime east of the river. Anyone who knows the Middle East, anyone who understands the complexity of the domestic reality in Jordan knows that the two cannot coexist peacefully.
And let me just ask you about that, because obviously this is born of a lot of hard experience. At the end of the day, Mr. Ambassador, what is it that animates that impossibility? What is it, in your view, that the sort of politically correct, if you will, the wishful thinkers are overlooking in their advocacy of a Palestinian state, a so-called two-state solution, and the peace process, as it's been known more generally?
Well, I think first and foremost, there is the genuine eagerness to have peace, genuine eagerness to resolve problems such as the Arab-Israeli, the Israeli-Palestinian problems. Sometimes, tragically, people tend to sacrifice reality on the altar of that eagerness to have peace. In order to have peace, it has to be based on reality, and we have seen that on numerous occasions, going back, for instance, to 1978-79, when President Jimmy Carter, in my mind, sincerely wanted to believe that Iran was ready for democracy. He genuinely believed that Ayatollah Khomeini was a man of peace, was a man who would advance democracy. He also believed that Ayatollah Khomeini is going to be controlled by the pro-U.S. military leaders. He sacrificed reality, and as a result, he in fact gave birth to the worst enemy of the U.S. in recent years. He gave birth to the appearance, the emergence of potentially a nuclear terror regime, the regime of the Ayatollahs in Iran. When it comes to a Palestinian state, it was President Clinton, and I admit, together with Israeli leaders, who ushered in Arafat all the way to receive the Nobel Prize for Peace, believing that he would be tempted by his newly found freedom in Judea and Samaria. I don't want to compare in any way to contemporary administration in Washington, but I firmly believe that it's a mistake to assume that in return for a nice economic financial package, the Muslim players in the Middle East, including the Palestinian leaders, are going to sacrifice their own ideology and their own Islamic religion in order to get a better standard of living and better balance of trade and much more leisure than they have today. If that would have been the case, there wouldn't be wars in the Middle East. There wouldn't be the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. In 1993, Israel provided the Palestinians with an unprecedented gift. We, in fact, in 1993, were the first entity allowing the Palestinians to exercise near independence in Judea and Samaria. People may not remember or may not be aware of that, but Jordan occupied the West Bank in 1950, and it never occurred to Jordan to allow Palestinians to enjoy any sort of independence. Egypt occupied Gaza in 1945, and it never occurred to them to provide independence to the Palestinians in Gaza. Israel did that in 1993 and then again in 1995 in Gaza. In return, we have been burdened by an unprecedented wave of terrorism.
It has not, in short, worked out, and the hard experience that should have warned that, you know, approach, that initiative, that policy off. And heavens knows, Mr. Ambassador, you were among the most vociferous in communicating that warning, both to your own government and people, and I think to those of us on this side of the pond. It went unheeded, and we're seeing, I'm afraid, the consequences of it. Mr. Ambassador, we have to pause for another brief break. When we come back, I want to talk further about some of these lessons, notably that of the Golan and mistakes that you did help avert, and also what's on the other side of the Golan at the moment, increasingly the threat from Iran. That and much more with Ambassador Yoram Edinger of Israel, straight ahead.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back. We're visiting with Ambassador Yoram Edinger, an extraordinarily clear thinker, a courageous advocate, and a man of deep experience with the harsh realities of life in the Middle East, as well as what America is all about and the importance of the relationship between the United States and Israel. This is a topic of his excellent product known as the Edinger Report. You can follow him at Yoram Edinger on Twitter, and I encourage you to do so. Mr. Ambassador, we're talking about the peace process over the years, and I saw recently a criticism of you for the role you played back in 1994 in helping to stave off an initiative that was being brooded at the time by Yitzhak Rabin of Israel, the prime minister then, and Bill Clinton here in the United States, which would have involved removing Israeli forces from the Golan Heights in favor of putting American troops up there to sort of keep things under control, even though it would have been surrendered back to Syria, which had used the Heights in the period prior to 1967 to attack Israel relentlessly, tried to take it back in the 73 war. Fortunately, it was repulsed. We at the Center for Security Policy played a small role in that, as of course did you, trying to make the case this was ill-advised. I wonder if you might do a thought experiment with us, Mr. Ambassador. What would Israel's situation be like now had that plan gone forward? Fortunately, it didn't. But where would Israel be at the moment? And how would the situation that's been playing out so horrifically in Syria with Iran and Hezbollah and the Russians and so on be looking in a world in which the Golan was actually in unfriendly hands?
Well, first and foremost, I would like to remind ourselves that in many respects, I followed in your own footsteps during those days of 94 and 95, and you did not play a small role. You played a major role. And as far as I recall, the focus of our efforts was not the Israeli perspective, but rather the potential impact on American interests. And we can see it today as well. Israel on the Golan Heights enhances or extends the U.S. strategic hand in the area without the need for American soldiers there. Israel on the Golan Heights means Israel on the trilateral border of Israel, Syria, and Jordan. Israel on the Golan Heights bolsters Jordan's domestic and external national security. Jordan's national security is critical to the survival of the pro-U.S. regimes south of Jordan in the Arabian Peninsula. Once there is no Hashemite regime in Jordan, the ripple effect are going to do away with every single pro-American Arab regime in Saudi Arabia, Abu Dhabi, Dubai, Oman, Kuwait, Bahrain, etc. And therefore, it is very important for the U.S. to have Israel rather than Syria or rather than ISIS or rather than pro-Ayatollah entity on the Golan Heights. Israel on the Golan Heights constrains severely the maneuverability of the Ayatollahs of Iran, who are expanding their influence through Iraq and Syria all the way to Lebanon and the Mediterranean. Israel on the Golan Heights constrains severely also the maneuverability of Russia. Israel on the Golan Heights, in fact, constitutes an extension of the eyes of the intelligence of the U.S. in that part of the globe. And therefore, going back to 94 and all the way to today, my own emphasis, as I know has been yours, the emphasis has been not necessarily on what would Golan Heights giveaway do to Israel, but also from the U.S. perspective, namely Israel's control of the Golan Heights enhances rather than undermine U.S. Interest. Israel on the Golan Heights does take away a lot from Russian influence and Ayatollah's influence in the region. And the same, by the way, applies to Israel on the mountain ridges of Judea and Samaria. Israel in the West Bank, Israel in the Golan Heights, bolsters Israel's posture of deterrence. Israel's posture of deterrence is a very unique asset to America's national security. Therefore, we have today unprecedented ties between Israel and Saudi Arabia, Israel and Jordan, Israel and Egypt, Israel and Bahrain. They do not cooperate with Israel because they are infatuated with the Jewish ideals and because they agree to Jewish sovereignty in what they consider to be the abode of Islam. They cooperate with Israel because they consider Israel as the most effective life insurance agent in the region. Once we are off the Golan Heights, once we retreat from the mountains of the West Bank, we lose that posture of deterrence, which means the U.S. loses a very powerful force multiplier in a strategic area of the world.
One of the arguments that has been made, as you know better than just about anybody, Ambassador Edinger, is that, well, this may not be a good idea strategically, but relinquishing this territory, particularly on the so-called West Bank, Judea and Samaria, as Israel previously did with Gaza, was necessary because of the demographic realities of the vastly larger birth rates and ultimately the population size of Palestinians, and that if they don't have a state of their own, that Israel will inevitably be overwhelmed by people who are not Jews, who are not seeking to be part of Israel, who in fact will simply by population numbers and growth alone take down the democratic state of Israel. You have challenged this so-called politically correct line of argument because you have found through a lot of your own research and that of other actual demographers that it happens not to be factually correct. Walk us through that and the kind of response you've gotten from the people who have built their whole two-state solution project on this particular argument.
Well, conventional wisdom has suggested that Jews multiply just like Westerners and Arabs multiply just like third worlders. The reality, however, has been very, very different. During the last 20 years, Arabs, or in fact Muslims, from Iran through Mauritania in northwest Africa, have gone through what I call demographic westernization. That means that in Iran, the ultra radical Islamic country, average woman produces almost two babies, slightly less than two babies per woman. On the other hand, in Israel, Jewish women have a fertility rate, number of babies per woman, which is higher than any Arab country other than Yemen, Iraq, and Egypt. We are talking today on an unprecedented demographic Jewish tailwind, and especially among secular Jews in Israel. Secular Jews who used to have one or two children 20 years ago, today have three or four children per woman. There is hardly a day that the gossip columns in the Israeli press do not report about a certain singer or certain actress who just gave birth to her third or fourth child. This is very different from what we have seen in the Western world, where there is a correlation or adverse correlation between the economic level and the fertility level. In Israel, there is a positive correlation. The higher the economic status, the higher the fertility. And as I said, especially when it comes to secular women, secular folks, and this has been a result of a very, very high level compared to other parts of the world, very high level of optimism, of patriotism, and attachment to roots. In Israel, you don't have to be right of center to be a patriot, a member of special operations, a member of the combat units in the military. In Israel, you don't have to be an observant Jew in order to show high respect towards Passover and other Jewish holidays. And certainly, when you're an optimist, you tend to produce children.
It's one of the most tangible ways in which that optimism can be expressed, as well as in terms of your commitment to the land in which you live. Yoram Edinger, we have to pause for one last break. We'll be right back with more, with the author of The Edinger Report, Required Reading. If you're interested in the fate of the free world, check it out and follow its author at Yoram Edinger. More right after this.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back for the fourth and final installment of this special and I think very timely and informative conversation with one of Israel's most, well, I believe, storied and accomplished advocates, both as a diplomat and now in his capacity as a commentator, a pundit, an analyst, the author of The Edinger Report. His name is Ambassador Yoram Edinger. Mr. Ambassador, again, thank you so much for giving this time to us. Let me just turn finally to a topic that at the moment seems to have receded a bit as a result of other distractions, but is a present and growing danger, not just for Israel, but I believe for our own country here in the United States and the world, and that is the Islamic Republic of Iran. Give us your current assessment of the state of the threat from the Iranian regime and the challenges that it is now increasingly facing, internal as well as external?
Well, as much as the Ayatollahs of Iran detest and hate Israel, they consider us, as they call it, the little Satan. They view the U.S. as the big Satan. And the reason is obvious. It is a geostrategic reason. The Ayatollah's first goal is to take over the Persian Gulf. To take over the Persian Gulf, they have to remove the American presence from the Persian Gulf. They want to take over the Arabian Peninsula and the entire Middle East. Once again, it's the U.S. which stands on their way. The Ayatollahs have an expansionist or megalomaniacal design. They're already in Central Asia, they're already in parts of Africa, they are very, very strong in the parts of South America, they are increasingly in Cuba and Venezuela, in Mexico, and they have their own cells already installed in the U.S. As far as they are concerned, we are the outpost of the U.S. in the Middle East, but their number one target happens to be the USA. The Iranians are not motivated by economic aspirations. The idea, or the faulty idea, of the 2015 accord with Iran, whereby they received $150 billion, which were supposed to do, according to the naive of their worldview, they were supposed to transform Iran into a peaceful country, only provided further energy to their megalomaniacal designs. In order to understand, in my mind, the conduct of Iran from 1979, when they took over Iran in a large way, complement of then President Jimmy Carter and his Secretary of State Cyrus Vance. But the conduct from then until today has been inspired by the fundamentals of Islam. And if we are to understand what do they do in Syria and in Lebanon and in Iraq and in the triangle between Argentina and Paraguay and Brazil, they are there in order to implement the precepts of Islam. And according to their own view, which we may consider outdated, which we may consider irrational, but for them, it's very rational. According to the Ayatollahs, Islam is the only legitimate religion. It's divinely ordained to rule the world. According to them, there is the war between the abode of the believers, the Muslims, and the abode of the infidel, all those who are not Muslims. According to them, agreements with infidel, whether it's the U.S., the Europeans, the U.N., agreements with the infidel, according to them, which means according to the Quran, they are non-binding. They are temporary ceasefire.
And of course, there's also this very strong conviction that any land that has ever been under the control of Muslims must ever be. So Israel being back on the ground in a very formal way in control of such land is an inherent problem and anathema to the mullahs and other Sharia supremacists as well, which gives rise, I guess, to, you know, the intractability of this problem. Mr. Ambassador, very quickly, what's the end game here, as you see it, vis-a-vis Iran?
Well, the end game vis-a-vis Iran and vis-a-vis other rogue regimes is to make every effort possible to stick by reality and avoid self-destruct wishful thinking. In the long run, there's no way that the Ayatollah regime is going to westernize itself. And for the U.S., for the world as a whole, to rid itself of the Ayatollah's regime would mean to rid the world of the Ayatollah regime itself, not only of their policies. The same, by the way, applies on Israel's border to Hezbollah terrorists in Syria and Lebanon, who are supported directly by Iran. The same thing applies to Hamas terrorists in Gaza, once again, who are supported by Iran. And the same thing, from a different point of view, applies to the Palestinian Authority. They are not stooges of Iran, but they have a goal. And the goal is not to build a fantastic education and health and economic systems and a great peaceful society. Their aim is what they call to liberate Palestine. And in order to understand what do they mean by liberation of Palestine, we have to realize that the PLO, which is the source of authority of the Palestinian Authority, was established in 1964, 3 years before Israel took over the West Bank. When they refer to liberation of Palestine, they refer to liberate Tel Aviv, to liberate Haifa, to liberate the coastal plain of Israel. They are talking about doing away with the Jewish state, which in their mind is an illegitimate entity, and no economic concessions and no appeasement and no gestures would change that very, very deep inherent ideology.
This is incredibly important. I think, especially as you say, Mr. Ambassador, that we build our security policies, both in Israel and in the United States, on the basis of realism, not wishful thinking. Let me ask you very quickly, Mr. Ambassador, we only have about 2 minutes left, about two other topics. One is, your country has, of course, been riven now for a protracted period of time over who will lead it, with stalemate after stalemate seemingly being the lot in life of the Israeli polity. Another election is looming. Will it, in your estimation, achieve the necessary breakthrough and enable a leader to emerge who can carry forth the vital security and other policy requirements of Israel?
Well, there's no doubt that we experience a major political quagmire. There's no doubt that the Israeli political system is inherently a non-functioning, probably overly democratic system. But the good news is that while during the last year and a half, it has been a complete domestic political havoc, the Israeli economy has surged in an unprecedented manner, according to GDP level, according to ratio of national debt to GDP, according to income per capita, etc., etc. And maybe, and I'm saying it obviously sarcastically, maybe it's good for a country to have a non-functioning political system, which allows the people to be freer and more productive.
This is the happiest gloss one can put on the rather unhappy prospects. And I'm afraid we have to leave it at that. There is another serious point that you wanted to make, and I wanted to ask you about the coronavirus, but this will be for another day. Ambassador Yoram Edinger, I can't tell you how much I appreciate your friendship, your collegial help and guidance for so many years, both to me personally, to the Center for Security Policy, to our radio program, and to our audience. I know that you will keep up the good work at the Edinger Report, and I hope we will have a chance to visit again very soon. I hope that we'll be talking with the rest of you again tomorrow, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.